Well, welcome everyone to this afternoon's Shiv Dasani lecture, the first one by Professor Joseph O'Connell, who's from the who's now retired from the University of Toronto, where he's taught religious studies for a long time. He's been a strong supporter of the Centre for many years, and we're very honoured and very pleased to have him with us this afternoon. And he's been doing some work in Dhaka, and he's an expert in the mainly in the Vaishnava traditions of Bengal. It was his work that first alerted me to the notion of Hindu being a late kind of word, you know, being a fairly late.
But not as late as some people thought it was.
Not as late, that's right. Not as late as some people thought it was.
In some ways, that's right.
And he's going to share his research with us this afternoon on with a slightly revised title of tracing Vaishnava strains in Tagore, because Tagore is one of his research interests as well. So, Professor O'Connell.
Thank you for the introduction, and thank you to the Centre and to the Shiv Dasani program, or Mr. Shiv Dasani, or the Shiv Dasani family that have brought me here, and also have brought Professor Ruby Sain from Jodhpur, the chair of the sociology department there. It's very good to see Kitty Dutto again after 10 years, and of course to see our home team folks here. I would not call myself a researcher on Rabindranath Tagore, but my wife is. Mm-hmm. And my wife prevailed upon me to accept an invitation to go to London and say something on the Vaishnava aspects of Rabindranath. And I was allowed myself to be talked into it, and this is the result of that. She says, you've been puttering around with Vaishnavas all these years. Surely you can say something. So I ended up reading a bit of Rabindranath and things about Rabindranath, but along the way I've absorbed a lot of Rabindranath as an educator, thanks to my good wife, whose second edition of this is just about to come out. There we go. This will be slightly different from what I did down in London. I've cut out some of the introductory information on the Vaishnavas in Bengal, but left some in also. I understand that these things are not only recorded, but they're actually available for broadcasting somewhere, so there ought to be a certain introductory aspect to it. Anyway, thank you for coming on a fine Friday afternoon. What I propose to do in this lecture is first to provide a brief account of salient characteristics of the Vaishnava tradition of devotion, that is, bhakti to God Krishna with Radha, his divine lover, that was inspired by Sri Krishna Chaitanya in Bengal, who lived in 1486 to 1533. And I also want to sketch something of the extent and the manner of Rabindranath's exposure to that tradition. I'll also point out the generally countervailing influence on him of the Brahma Samaj as mediated by his father, Maharshi Dabendranath Tagore. With these considerations as a background, we then may look at certain of Rabindranath's prose writings in which there is explicit Vaishnava reference. We may ask how intimately and accurately he understood the Vaishnava elements he treats, and how approving or critical he was of them, and in what ways, and why. We may also inquire, if we have time, of selections from his poems in the English Gitanjali, where, without explicit reference to Vaishnava moods and motifs, he does have some references. In these poetic examples, we may consider how Rabindranath's conception of a broadly common element or theme was consonant with typical Vaishnava understanding, but also how in almost all cases he construed somewhat differently even what he shared. We should expect there to be such subtle differences in view of his far more cosmopolitan mentality and his personal religious orientation, which was not specifically that of a Vaishnava devotee of God as Krishna, but rather a more generic theism, or what he eventually came to call the religion of man. We might hope to gain, through this sort of inquiry, some insight into how particular elements of a complex cultural tradition can enter into, influence, and in the process be refashioned by a highly creative personality. This exploratory probe will not take us very far in reaching these intended goals, but let's make a start. Your corrections, suggestions, and further contributions to the task would be much appreciated. This Vaishnava tradition, inspired by Chaitanya in the 16th century, has continued to be a significant component of the Bengali religio-cultural complex. ever since, due in large part to its impressive production of Bengali and also Sanskrit religious literature. A blending of aesthetic and theological, emotional and devotional, erotic and mystical elements in Bengali Vaishnava literature and song has enabled Vaishnava sensibilities to permeate and influence a broad spectrum of Bengali mentalities, Hindu and Muslim, Vaishnava certainly and Shakta, devout and secular, culturally sophisticated and also rustic. It is in relation to this Vaishnava-influenced religio-cultural milieu that I am concerned to trace Vaishnava strains in the mentality and writing of Rabindranath Tagore, receptive as he was to so vast a range of Bengali, Indian, and global cultural phenomena. Now, what are some of the fundamental themes and sentiments of these Vaishnavas that we might expect to have been well known to and to have influenced to some degree others in Bengal, not least being Rabindranath Tagore? Very basic is their insistence on the primacy of love as the essential quality of religious devotion to God and as such the ultimate ideal of human life. Prema Bhakti, loving devotion, is their ideal of the human-divine relationship, a reflection, they say, of the essential relationship within the androgynously conceived divinity of Krishna with Radha. Vaishnavas further emphasize that such loving devotion is most intense, purified and authentic when tested by the absence of the beloved, however painful such love and separation, or viraha as it's called, may be. For love to be most perfect, most pleasing to God, Krishna, which they affirm to be the ultimate purpose of all existence, it should also be spontaneous and free, free of constraint, free of fear, free of obligation and authority. Vaishnavas speak of this as madhurya, sweetness or gentleness. Moreover, the Vaishnavas declare that loving devotion expressed in mutual service should be the norm for interaction among humans in mundane affairs as well. For, even though union with the divine in the most lovable form of Krishna may remain tormentingly elusive, Vaishnavas still acknowledge some divine presence as the inner self of each individual person or jiva. Accordingly, through their literature and devotional practices, sadhana, they are expected to foster a non-violent, accommodating ethos and a sense of respect for fellow humans as actual or potential devotees and as bearers of the divine within. The Vaishnavas in Bengal put great stress on the beauty of the divine couple in their idyllic transcendent realm, which they visualize and express through poetry, song, and drama. They likewise stress the physical beauty and charm of Chaitanya, or Gauranga, the golden-bodied one. Accentuation of visual beauty, literary refinement, and music, all attuned to devotional sentiments, give the Vaishnava tradition in Bengal a decidedly aesthetic quality. The aesthetic emphasis is not, however, limited to elite circles of Vaishnava literateurs. As Tagore himself has attested, Vaishnava poetry and song exhibit a degree of freedom from fixed literary conventions that enables them to express human emotions, in his words, that surged up in the mass mind, simply and effectively. The combination of aesthetic beauty, imagination, and emotional expressiveness is especially evident in Bengali Vaishnava song, kirtan, whether it be group singing of the names of God, Nam Kirtan, lyrical hymns, Padavali Kirtan, or in dramatic performances of theme-related songs called Leela Kirtan. Now, the group singing of Nam Kirtan has a further social implication. It not only symbolizes and affects the emotionally expressive and aesthetic aspects of the Vaishnava devotion in Bengal, but lends collective empowerment to its popular egalitarian thrust. As Hitesh Ranjan Sanyal has reported, such group kirtan traditionally has given a sense of solidarity and confidence to otherwise timid and unorganized peasant folk. This egalitarian collective dynamism of the Vaishnava tradition in Bengal goes back to the time of Chaitanya. Even though it rarely led to radical social or political change, it served to enhance the self-respect and dignity of the disadvantaged and has remained an evocative symbol for aspiring toward a more egalitarian and humane conception of society, as Rabindranath explicitly depicted in some of his fiction and nonfiction. On the other hand, as the Vaishnava tradition in Bengal became more organizationally structured in subsequent generations, with leadership largely in the hands of hereditary gurus, mostly Brahmin Goswamis, its egalitarian and mildly reformist thrust weakened, and opportunities emerged for exploiting the faith of simple devotees, a theme also articulated by Tagore. But mediating, as it were, the image gap between the more egalitarian and the more exploitive characterizations of Bengali Vaishnavas is the Vairagi, or Vairagi, the one who is passionless, detached, the wandering Vaishnava mendicant, often enough himself a singer of kirtan. All these images and influences of the Vaishnavas were circulating in the popular and literary milieu in which Rabindranath lived and of which he was well aware. The section on exposure of Rabindranath to Vaishnava influence. There was considerable exposure of Rabindranath to Vaishnava influences, especially in his early impressionable years. The family into which he was born had been for generations a traditional Vaishnava one. His grandfather, Dharkanath Tagore, provided funds for Vaishnavas and opposed restrictions on religious processions, so popular with kirtan singing Vaishnavas. Devendranath, the poet's father, as noted by Kathleen O'Connell, quote, used to accompany his Didimar, a grandaunt in this case, when she went to worship and cry bitterly if she went on a pilgrimage to Puri or Brindaban, both Vaishnava sites, without taking him. Sometimes Alakasundari would hold all-night Vaishnava festivals of musical kirtan and stories, and at other times take Devendranath to the old family house to see the family idol Gopinath Thakur, close quote. Sister Nivedita, Margaret Noble, Sharna Kumari, Rabindranath's sister, and others reported that the women of the Tagore household were orthodox Vaishnavas and were tutored by Jati Vaishnava women recommended by the Brahmin Goswami women of the Vaishnava Kardaha temple. Various Hindu pujas and Vaishnava kirtan recitals were held within the Jorasanko household where Tagore grew up, which impressionable young Rabindranath would have witnessed. Rabindranath himself tells of his excitement when a collection of old lyrical poems composed by the poets of the Vaishnava sect came into his hands when he was no more than 14, perhaps a bit earlier. Rabindranath and his elder brother Dijendranath are reported to have read and enjoyed the Bhagavata Purana, though more for its romantic rendering of the Krishna and romantic rendering of Krishna and his sweethearts rather than for its treatment of him as God. Rabindranath himself confided to Hemantabala Devi many years later that he had at one time drowned himself in the 16th century Chaitanya Bhagavata, a sacred biography of Chaitanya by Brindaban Das, but that the same path that had taken him there also drew him away. Throughout his early and middle years, Rabindranath would have been aware of a not insignificant buzz over Bengali Vaishnava matters, some of it addressing critically or defensively orthodox devotional practices such as image worship, some of it decrying alleged sexually transgressive practices of marginal Vaishnava Sahajiya and hybrid quasi-Vaishnava sects, much of it enthusiastic literary recovery, publication and discussion of pre-colonial Bengali Vaishnava literature. He would have known of, and in some cases known personally, prominent individuals associated in various ways with Vaishnava affairs, Bunkam Chandra Chatterjee, Keshav Chandra Sen, Vijay Krishna Goswami, Ramakrishna Paramahansa, possibly Kedarnath Dutta, Bhaktivinod Thakur. In terms of formal religious philosophy, Rabindranath, as a young man, would have been more forcefully influenced by the Neo-Vedanta of the Brahmo Samaj tradition, with its emphasis on the Upanishads, more so than by any Vaishnava school of thought. However, both he and his father favored a more loving, caring, personal interpretation of the divine Brahman than did Ram Mohan Roy or other yet more rationalist or monist Neo-Vedantins. While Rabindranath did not address the divine as Krishna or by any other anthropomorphic, if you will, name and form of the divine, he often wrote of a personal divine presence within his heart, the Jivan Devata, the Moner Manush, much as Vaishnavas would speak of God within the individual soul as Paramatman. He is said to have been attracted to the theistic Vishishtadvaita of the 11th century Ramanuja, but I am not aware of his having studied any of the works of the Vrindavan Goswamis that form the theological backbone of the Vaishnava tradition in Bengal. The countervailing influence of Devendranath Tagore, his father, and the Brahmo Samaj. Contrasting with the traditionally Hindu and specifically Vaishnava milieu to which Rabindranath was exposed from his childhood, was the strong influence of his father, Maharshi Devendranath Tagore, leader for many years of the Brahmo Samaj. Initially, Rabindranath was more or less comfortable with the Brahmos and their ideals of personal, though non-anthropomorphic, monotheism and ethical responsibility. He served as secretary of the Samaj for a number of years and composed Brahmo hymns. But he was so receptive to human and natural realities in their fullness and so imaginative and creative that he eventually outgrew this narrow regimen and withdrew from membership. Nevertheless, the impact of Brahmo principles on him in his early and middle adulthood was considerable, and the Brahmo emphases on individual responsibility, on seeking truth versus superstition and prejudice, on avoiding idol worship, on working for social justice, and on discretion in speaking about sexual matters seem never to have left him. So let's now come to Tagore's explicit treatment of Vaishnavas and Vaishnava themes. We begin with Bhanu Sinher Padavali and Padavali Kirtan. It was a volume of poems by the Maithili, northern Bihar, poet Vidyapati, discovered in the family library that triggered young Robi's fascination with both the archaic language and the poetic content of medieval lyrics on the Vaishnava theme of love between Radha and Krishna. As a precocious early teen, Rabindranath took great pains to decipher the archaic, conventional Brajabuli language in which these and many other Vaishnava hymns, Padavali, were written. Animated by fascination for decoding the peculiar language of the poems and for the romantic spirit of their content, he then composed an imitation, and in Brajabuli, a remarkable set of Padavali of his own, for which he teasingly declined to claim membership or authorship for several years. About that discovery of Vidyapati's lyrics, Rabindranath later wrote, quote, "Fortunately for me, a collection of old lyrical poems composed by the poets of the Vaishnava sect came to my hand when I was young. I became aware of some underlying idea deep in the obvious meaning of these love poems. I felt the joy of an explorer who suddenly discovers the key to the language lying hidden in the hieroglyphs, which are beautiful in themselves. I was sure that these poems were speaking about the Supreme Lover, whose touch we experience in all our relations of love, the love of nature's beauty, of the animal, the child, the comrade, the beloved, the love that illuminates our consciousness of reality. They sang of a love that ever flows through numerous obstacles between men and man the divine, the eternal relation which has the mutual relationship of mutual dependence for a fulfillment that needs the perfect union of individuals and the universal. The Vaishnava poet sings of the lover who has his flute, which, with its different stops, gives out the varied notes of beauty and love that are in nature and man." End of quote. The encounter with the Vaishnava poems, the Padavali, obviously had a deeply moving impact on young Rabindranath, but more than that, as Tony K. Stewart points out in a recent translation of Bhanu Sinher Padavali by him and Chase Twitchell, those compositions remained a lifelong concern for the poet. By examining subsequent editions of the poems and the changes Rabindranath made to them, Stewart observes that the tone and character of them changes from more or less straight imitation of Radha Krishna eroticism to a more universalized spirituality. Let me quote Stewart at some length here, as he has labored long over the poems and knows them well. "There is a subtle increase in," end quoting, "there's a subtle increase in ambiguity, or rather, less Vaishnava specificity, a tendency to generalize and abstract from what was in earlier versions more precisely delineated. The dominant erotic mode subtly gives way to a humility in the face of unrequited love, especially when the focus of the poem shifts from Radha, the proper subject for a Vaishnava lyric, to her confidant Bhanu. Out of humility, the devotee ought never be the subject. It is a shift that is consonant with Rabindranath's mature religious sensibility. Krishna does not remain the cowherding cad of Braj, but seems to be recognized as the Lord, immanent in all creatures and in the hearts of his devotees." One is reminded of Rabindranath's attitude of reverence and submission to his Jivan Devatar, his indwelling Lord. End of quote. For Rabindranath, Radha, with her prolonged torment of separation and longing, viraha, for him, Radha is not the eternal divine consort of Krishna, but rather a symbolic embodiment of intense human emotions, an extreme exemplar, perhaps, of what the poet would later call the religion of man. Nor does he, so far as I know, in his later compositions, again explicitly imitate Vaishnava lyrics, though some may come close. What he does do, however, is carry over into humane poetry and song much of the same emotional sensibility, psychological insight, and religio-aesthetic values as animate and refine Vaishnava Padavali. There is another significant affinity or parallel between Vaishnava Padavali Kirtan and the poet's own songs, Rabindra Sangeet, namely the merging of poetry and music in song. This merging is a characteristic that he highlights, along with flexibility, openness to expressing feelings, and minimal formal ornamentation when extolling the merits of Kirtan. Though his own songs may have more elaborate and refined structure than Kirtan, the matching of emotion to musical form and the urge toward freedom from fixed literary conventions of expression are Kirtan-like qualities that he would emphasize in his own compositions. Now, how much these underlying similarities should be attributed to influence from the Vaishnava tradition, and how much to Rabindranath's own sensibility developed in relation to so many other external stimuli, I cannot say with confidence, as I do not know Rabindranath's life and work well enough. But I strongly suspect that the Vaishnava influence, direct and indirect, was considerable. Before we leave Tagore's lyric poetry and song, let me give a sample of Chase Twitchell's very free, expressive rendering of the final poem of Bhanusena Padavali. I've fallen from my life, my friend. My tears since birth have washed away my charms. But I've known pure love. If I glimpse for an instant my own dark lord in the forest path, I kiss the dust at his feet 100 times, as if each grain were a jewel. Unlucky, star-crossed birth, I long only to stay within the shadow of his flute and taste from afar his dark smile. Radha is the dark lord's mistress. May her pleasure be endless. But it's grief that's endless, a river of unseen tears. Is your indifference endless also, black one? Its half-bloomed flowers fall unseen into the river of human tears. We shift to Chaturanga. Chaturanga is a short but intense and tightly structured novel in which one of the four main characters is a Vaishnava, Swami Lilananda. Tagore's treatment of the Swami in relation to his disciples amounts to a sustained critique of Vaishnava preoccupation or obsession with devotional sentiment, rasa, induced by group indulgence in kirtan. In this case, it is no longer the expressive virtues of kirtan that Tagore has celebrated elsewhere, but its alleged misuse in suppressing participants' sense of reality and responsibility. Here he treats Lilananda's kirtan regimen as inducing an artificial mentality which is not cognizant of the individual, personal feelings and needs of others, in particular of the heroine Damini, and which blinds its devotees to ethical issues and social duties. He criticizes reliance on artificial symbol, rupaka, in place of appreciating real form or beauty, rupa. Tagore's treatment of Swami Lilananda himself is detailed and insightful, but on the whole, negatively critical. He evidently acknowledges the skill and, in its own obsessive way, the coherence or integrity of the Swami's modus operandi. There is no allegation of rank dishonesty, fraud, or sexual indulgence by the Swami, though he is presented as a master of manipulation to keep, if possible, the prestigious former young male atheist Sachish and Sri Balas, as well as the attractive young widow Damini, in his retinue. Let me quote here, as recounted by Sri Balas, the narrator, in Ashok Mitra's translation, a passage from Chaturanga, demonstrating Tagore's sensitive treatment of Damini as she submits, ephemerally and temporally, as it turns out, to the guruship of Lilananda under the seductive influence of Vaishnava song. The day has waned when at last we meet at the turning, and as I try to see your face, the last ray of evening fades into the night. We had heard that song before, but never with such complete rapport between singer, audience, and surroundings. Domini was affected to tears. Swami went on to the second verse. I shall not grieve that the darkness comes between thee and my sight. Only for a moment stand before me, that I may kiss thy feet and wipe them with my hair. When he had come to the end, the placid, eventide, enveloping sky and waters was filled like some ripe golden fruit with the bursting sweetness and melody. Domini rose and went up to the master. As she prostrated herself at his feet, her loose hair slipped off her shoulders and was scattered over the ground on either side. She remained long thus before she raised her head. End of the passage. Here, as Tagore deftly analyzes the personal dynamics of disciples straining to please their guru, and the latter ever ready to accept their fealty, I find myself wondering if he may be holding up, as it were, a mirror for his own self-reflection and warning. By this time in his life, he too was being revered as a guru by many who were charmed by his song and drawn to the mildly idyllic way of life in his rustic Shantiniketan. When we shift attention away from the problematic Swami Lilananda toward the tragic young heroine Domini, we find a striking resonance, I think, with Radha or the Bhanusinha Padavali. Both women are courageous, capable of intense, self-sacrificing love. Both face social restrictions and abuse for their intense, unconventional love. Each dedicates herself to a male, young Shachish, in Domini's case, Krishna in Radha's, who, despite his charms and passion, is all too often unresponsive to her feelings, abandons her, and causes her great pain. Yet he still remains the cherished object of her great love, a love that deepens the more she endures the pain of separation, viraha. Radha in the song laments, I've fallen from my life friend, my tears since birth have washed my charms away. Domini in the novel actually dies from an injury inflicted upon her unwittingly by her idol, the unresponsive, beloved, and ultimate guru, Shachish. Rabindranath, throughout his career, remained the champion of the talented, courageous, but unappreciated and victimized women, as depicted in the Vaishnava image of Radha and the humane image of Domini. Bhoshtami. In a short story called Bhoshtami, Rabindranath displays his acquaintance with another aspect of the overall Vaishnava phenomenon in Bengal, a socially marginal group known as Jati Vaishnavas, or Jat Bhoshtam, or simply Bhoshtam. Generally poor and of relatively low status, this group includes married members, celibates who have renounced marriage to foster devotional life, and others ambiguously, neither obviously married nor celibate. Some support themselves by singing kirtan and begging, some by diverse other occupations. The Bhoshtami, the female Bhoshtam, in the story is a somewhat mysterious figure, reflecting the paradoxical character of the whole Jati Vaishnava caste without caste, as it's sometimes called. She enters the scene suddenly, introducing herself to the narrator, whom she surprisingly calls Gaur, short for Gauranga, Chaitanya, after having lived a number of years as a Bhoshtami. She evidently had overcome earlier and somewhat undisciplined ways and become an exemplary Vaishnava, radiating humility, nonviolence, love of all things, and displaying insight into the meaning of life. She at length discloses to the narrator that out of penance for her negligence in the death of her son and for complicity in mental, though not physical, seduction by her husband's guru, she renounced married life to live as a Bhoshtami in pursuit of, quote, truth and truth alone. She tells the narrator, in this world of mine, quoting, there were only two who loved me best, my boy and my husband. That love was my God, and therefore it could brook no falsehood. One of those two left me. He drowned in the pond when she was distracted and should have been paying attention. Left me, and I left the other. She left her husband when she realized she had been unfaithful to him, so she voluntarily left. The eminent Vaishnava scholar Biman Bihari Majumdar considers that, quote, the highest ideal of Vaishnavism has been portrayed in the character of the Bhoshtami, close quote. Perhaps. But my own reading is that while Tagore does portray favorably her virtues attained in maturity, he remains non-committal and non-judgmental about her early life and the unrecorded intervening years living as a Bhoshtami. Prayaschita and Achalayatam. In the drama Prayaschita, penance, there is a radically different portrayal of a radically different type of prominent Vaishnava, the ascetic Bairagi, the one who is passion-free. The theme of a saintly Vaishnava or other ascetic figure leading downtrodden or harassed subjects in a successful protest against repressive material forces is one that we find in several of Tagore's prose works, especially in the first two decades of the 20th century. In Prayaschita, he portrays a Vaishnava ascetic, Dhananjoy Bairagi, leading poor but courageous peasants in a non-violent anti-rent protest against Raja Pratap Aditya of Jessore. That Tagore was acquainted with the popular story of Chaitanya, who successfully leading a mass protest against one Chankazi, who had disrupted a mass kirtan, is virtually certain. That story features prominently in Vrindavan Das's classic 16th century biography, Chaitanya Bhagavata, in which, as Tagore acknowledged, he at one time immersed himself. The Raja, like Chaitanya's Kazi, is profoundly moved in the story, in the drama, by the integrity and fearlessness of the Bairagi. Pratap Aditya is even depicted as declaring that he too would like to take to the path of, presumably Vaishnava, renunciation. That ordinary people could be stirred to overcome fear even during communal riots by group chanting of kirtan is not far-fetched if we may credit the explicit accounts given in Hitesh Ranjan Sanyal's Bangla Kirtan Itihash of Hindu peasants during the 1946 Kumila riots in Noakhali in rural East Bengal. In Tagore's Acharyatan, it is again a guru who leads low-caste tribal people in a protest against a fortress-like educational institution where rigid maintenance of traditional customs is stifling creativity and vitality. Here the guru is a beacon of freedom and a champion of the poor and weak, a far cry from the exploitive or obscurantist gurus presented in Chaturanga and Boshtami. The guru succeeds in breaking down the walls of the institution, thereby bringing freedom and vitality to its inmates and the common folk thereabout. Rabindranath evidently knew his Vaishnava and other Hindu religious types well enough and was perceptive and fair-minded enough to distinguish and depict the range of variations, the good, the bad, the mixed among them. From fiction to letters to Hemantabala Devi. In letters written to one Hemantabala Devi in the early 1930s, when Tagore was about 70, some 20 years after Chaturanga, Boshtami, and Prayaschita, we find, among other topics, a blunt person-to-person critique of Vaishnava practices akin to what appears as fiction in Chaturanga. In this later correspondence, however, it is dedication to image worship, as practiced and defended by Hemantabala, rather than devotional rapture or ecstasy, to use Ashok Mitra's term, artificially aroused by Kirtan Leelananda's kirtan, that is the butt of his criticism. But the moral basis of the criticism remains much the same: irresponsible neglect of the needs of fellow humans, especially the poor and vulnerable, in favor of indulgence in emotional self-satisfaction, whether it be by singing kirtan or serving the deity in your temple room. In the earliest letters in their correspondence, Rabindranath is very critical of Vaishnava preoccupation with ritualized service of the deity in iconic form, though he repeatedly assures Hemantabala that he is not at all angry with her. Hemantabala evidently kept declaring her satisfaction in performing service to the divine in the form of her iconic image, as Rabindranath keeps reiterating his position in replies to her frequent letters, which unfortunately are not included in Chittipatra, where the Tagore letters are. The evidently forceful young Hemantabala must have challenged Rabindranath to admit his own Vaishnava-like qualities, for he replies, here I quote, from the Bangla, "You seek the Vaishnava within me. He has not fled, but together with him is the ascetic Shaiva, beggar and ascetic, the flute of the king of sentiment, king of rasa, Krishna, is sounding, but there is also the dancing of the king of the dance, Shiva. The boat flows on the Yamuna, Krishna's river by Vrindavan, but in the end it plunges into the Ganga, Shiva's river of Varanasi, which Ganga, donning ochre garments, goes to the sea." Close quote. Further put on the defensive, it would seem, by Hemantabala, Rabindranath concedes that as poet he too uses images, but explains that he does not treat them as divine realities, as in a transcendent sense would orthodox Vaishnavas. He goes on to explain that the images he uses follow from or depend upon the feelings he wants to express. They have no priority over real feelings, nor any independent significance in his work. The images, the symbols, can be changed for the sake of expressing feelings better. In a rather interesting twist to Rabindranath's conception of the self-sacrificing character of women, he accounts for Hemantabala's desire to ritually feed and otherwise do service, seva, for her iconic lord, Thakur, presumably an image of Krishna, as due to her female gender. Women by nature, he opines, desire to nourish their children and spouses, and this carries over to their devotion to the religious image. He also acknowledges the presence, but of a less prominent sort, of desire for serving on the part of males like himself, but insists that his desire to serve is to serve fellow humans, not the image in the temple. After a couple of months of surprisingly frequent correspondence in 1931, Rabindranath softened his critique of Hemantabala's icon-focused Vaishnava devotional service. He assured her that it was quite right for her to continue that service and to remain faithful to her, presumably Vaishnava, guru. By this point in the correspondence, he was becoming enthusiastic about her literary talent and more inclined to discuss with her literature than religion. I suspect that as he came to appreciate how impressive a person she could be, despite what he would call her image worship, he began to soften, or at any event cease applying to her, the brusque moralistic stereotype of Vaishnava icon worshippers as deluded, morally irresponsible seekers after selfish emotional satisfaction. Whether or not, thanks to recognizing Hemantabala's evident capacity to be a devout image-worshipping Vaishnava, while still being a talented and engaging writer and correspondent, whether Rabindranath in his 70s became more open to appreciating Vaishnava devotees generally for the real people they are, as Swami Lilananda had failed to do, rather than as instances of artificial stereotypes, it would be instructive to inquire and perhaps determine. Now, the last portion, Vaishnava strains implicit in Gitanjali. It would seem likely that much more could be learned of Vaishnava resonances in the mind, heart, and work of Rabindranath Tagore by reviewing his songs and poems, both in their Bangla originals and in English translations or adaptations of them, as done by the poet himself. Here, as a suggestive small sample, let's look at maybe three or four songs from his English Gitanjali, the song offerings for which he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1913. Number two, when thou commandest me to sing, it seems that my heart would break with pride, and I look to thy face and tears come to my eyes. All that is harsh and dissonant in my life melts into one sweet harmony, and my adoration spreads wings like a glad bird in its flight across the sea. I know that thou takes pleasure in my singing. I know that only as a singer I come before thy presence. I touch by the edge of the far-spreading wing of my song thy feet, which I could never aspire to reach. Drunk with the joy of singing, I forget myself and call thee friend who art my Lord. That song is at the heart of both Vaishnava's and Rabindranath's conception of what is quintessentially humane and spiritual experience is beyond question. Rabindranath's delight with the divine command to sing before thy presence because the divine takes pleasure in the singing is akin to Vaishnava's yearning to be admitted to the circle of Krishna's intimates and assigned some small task to contribute to his pleasure. Drunk with the joy of singing, I forget myself and call thee friend who art my Lord. Vaishnavas, like the poet songster in Rabindranath, revel in forgetting themselves and in forgetting that the lovable human like Krishna is God Almighty. They treat God as friend, child, lover. They do not, however, simply credit the singing itself with this power of forgetting, as Rabindranath seems to, but attribute it to Yoga Maya, a personified divine power of provident concealment and deception. Rabindranath, like the Vaishnavas, extols the freedom, spontaneity, and and play that animate Vaishnava literature in Bengal, and Vaishnavas like Tagore desire to look upon the face of God while acknowledging their unworthiness. And even more so than Rabindranath, are all too prone, at least in those days, to breaking into tears of joy or grief or other human emotion. Number 18. Clouds heap upon clouds and it darkens. Ah, love, why dost thou let me wait outside the door all alone? In the busy moments of the noontide, I work and am with the crowd, but in this dark, lonely day, it is only for thee that I hope. If thou showest me not thy face, if thou leavest me wholly aside, I know not how I am to pass these long rainy hours. I keep gazing in the faraway gloom of the sky, and my heart wanders wailing with the restless wind. What Rabindranath here expresses is a classic expression of viraha, painful longing and separation and neglect from the beloved. It resonates, though in a less melodramatic tone, so many Abhisarika songs, wherein Radha goes out to meet Krishna on dark, rainy nights. But we may note in Tagore's poem the absence of the somewhat melodramatic Vaishnava imagery of rain-soaked body, danger from snakes, and the like. Rather, for the mature Rabindranath, who's in his 50s or 60s by this time, who recently had lost to death his wife, his father, his children, his favorite teacher, and years before, his beloved sister-in-law, Kamyus Kadambari. His is the patient longing and sadness of a lonely person waiting through another gloomy day. But still, like the Vaishnava poets, it makes fine poetic use, though not so agonistic, of imagery from nature. My heart wanders, wailing with the restless wind. Number 11, a bit different. Leave this chanting and singing and telling of beads. Whom dost thou worship in this lonely dark corner of a temple with doors all shut? Open thine eyes and see thy God is not before thee. He is there where the tiller is tilling the hard ground and where the pathmaker is breaking stones. He is with them in the sun and in shower, and his garment is covered with dust. Put off thy holy mantle, and even like him come down on the dusty soil. Deliverance? Where is this deliverance to be found? Our Master himself has joyfully taken upon him the bonds of creation. He is bound with us all forever. Come out of thy meditations and leave aside thy flowers and incense. What harm is there if thy clothes become tattered and stained? Meet him and stand by him in toil and in sweat of thy brow. Of all the songs and poems in the English Gitanjali, this may be the most critical of what are obviously Vaishnava practices, though some would apply to a wider range of traditional Hindu religious activity. Chanting, singing, telling of beads, temples, deliverance, meditations, flowers, incense, all these are typical expressions of Vaishnava piety in Bengal. Vaishnavas themselves, of course, might well reply that they too have a fundamentally egalitarian commitment to the poor and the burdened, although the way they express that commitment lies more in sharing Krishna bhakti and expressing solidarity with them than it does in active social or political work for them. But lest we leave our probe into Gitanjali on a mildly sour anti-Vaishnava note, let me read number 34. Let only that little be left of me whereby I may name thee my all. Let only that little be left of me whereby I may feel thee on every side and come to thee in everything and offer to thee my love every moment. Let only that little be left of me whereby I may never hide thee. Let only that little of my fetters be left whereby I am bound with thy will and thy purpose is carried out in my life, and that is the fetter of thy love. This brief song, humble and devout, is so quintessentially Vaishnava in its spirit and phraseology that, were it given in Bangla and without attribution, might well pass for a prayerful hymn in the Rotam Das's celebrated Pratana. So, some summary reflections. From Vaishnava Bhakti to the Rabindranath's Religion of Man, Resonance and Dissonance. From what we know of Rabindranath's childhood, as subject to the Vaishnava influences of the women within a traditionally Vaishnava family, and of his adolescent and adult exposure to and experimenting with Vaishnava literature, it is evident that he was well acquainted with that stream within the complex Bengali religio-cultural milieu of his time. That acquaintance, however, was far from a passive acquiescent one. Even in his most enthusiastic engagement with Vaishnava lyrics as a teenager, early teenager, Rabindranath did not hesitate to manipulate the form of Radha Krishna Padavali to suit his precocious fancy. In later depictions of Vaishnava figures and institutions, and in some correspondence and other non-fictional prose, and also implicitly in his poetry and song, he selectively chose to salute those aspects of the Vaishnava tradition that he favored and to castigate those he found wanting, be it on aesthetic, religious, or ethical grounds. The Vaishnava's sense of the divine as personal and as present within each human heart, the prominence of love and beauty as Vaishnava values, the pain of separation from one's beloved, human or divine, the flexibility and freedom of Vaishnava lyrics to express such feelings, the humane, egalitarian promise of the Vaishnava ethos, all these aspects of the Vaishnava tradition in Bengal resonated with his own sensibilities and very likely helped shape and reinforce them. On the other hand, what he considered their exaggerated emotionalism, narrowing of religious and literary sensibility to the erotic pastimes of Krishna Radha, alleged neglect of responsibility for suffering humanity in favor of childish service of graven images, self-indulgent rapture through kirtan, song and music, exploitation of the credulous by unscrupulous gurus and custodians of temples, all these aspects or distortions of Bengali Vaishnava tradition ran counter to Rabindranath's ethical and broadly humane religion of man and drew his censure. A more extensive inquiry into the prose and especially into the Bangla poetry of Rabindranath Tagore would, I suggest, disclose yet more persuasive evidence than has been garnered in this limited probe. Evidence that, notwithstanding his critique of Vaishnava sectarian institutions, in his underlying aesthetic sensibilities, in his underlying religio-aesthetic sensibilities, the poet was profoundly in harmony with the Vaishnava tradition in Bengal and very likely indebted to that tradition for its influence in nurturing within him an emotionally expressive, poetically refined, egalitarian conception of the human relationship with the divine. Amen. My apologies for speaking without break, but Kitty undoubtedly knows vastly more of Tagore than I do, and it was embarrassing enough to be in the room with you to have all of these worthies down in London, but what do you do?
In fact, the opposite. It has impelled me to go back to Chaturanga or something.
Please do. Please do.
Stories and reread them.
Reread them, yes.
What you're saying does chime with my own perceptions, and it was wonderful to have the Gitanjali poems used to illustrate Vaishnava. Don't you think?
Well, from what you were saying, it seems that you can't understand Tagore without this background.
Well, you know, you can't fully understand him without it, but there are other backgrounds that come into Rabindranath. And, well, I think the answer is yes. No, we can't exhaustively understand Rabindranath, but I really feel that there is an aspect of Rabindranath that you won't understand until you do look at the Vaishnava side. And I have been selective in the Gitanjali poems that I pulled out. I get others that are not, you would know how he ranges over many ones. I took the ones that most did it. Yes. But people like Ketaki, Shabuj Kohli at Vishwabharati have, you know, voluntarily said, but you should read such and such, or you should read such and such as even more Vaishnavite. I read some Bangla. But not that much, and the poetry is harder for me than the prose, so I pretty well have to depend on people like yourselves to push this further, but I would be delighted if you would. And
What do you think about another?
Well, I spoke rather rapidly, and that was unfair, but...
It's perfect.
Thanks.
I have two questions. One is, how much is his attitude towards the Vaishnava groups and practices and attitudes and so on, is it unique to him, and how much is it sort of shared with, I mean, of course, you mentioned his father and mm-hmm. but like other people of the Brahma Samaj or beyond that in Bengal at the time.
It depends which Bengalis you're looking at, but if you're looking at the more sophisticated, intellectually, literary oriented Bhadraloka of the time, they would probably, and many of them would share his critique side of the Vaishnavas. Certainly in the Brahma Samaj, they were very unhappy with image worship. They were also unhappy with the slaughtering of animals in the Shakta side. Whether they would have been as sensitive to the positive elements, the groundswell of Vaishnava sentiments as Tagore, I think few of them would have that poetic sensibility to have absorbed, or if you will, be on the same wavelength with this underlying aesthetic sentiment, which is so very much part of his religious awareness of transcendence. The population, a bit more broadly, they're all over the lot. You had defenders of the Vaishnava tradition, though we don't hear much about them from scholarship on the Bengal Renaissance until this group. It's largely recent ISKCON devotees or former ISKCON devotees who are actually looking at Vaishnava elements in the 19th century. We've heard a lot about the Brahma Samaj types. We hear a lot about the rationalist critique. We hear a lot about the nasty things some of the missionaries said, but not too much of the Vaishnava side. So I'd say you're going to find a spectrum, but by and large, I think that his critical elements would be more widely spread. The more sophisticated you get, the less sophisticated, more into the traditional Vaishnava way of doing things. But depending on how poetic they were themselves, they might or might not have sort of the richness of Tagore's resonance with Vaishnava underlying sentiments. But we have several people in this, in the room and in the wider group that have been associated with this Oxford Center for Hindu Studies, who are doing in intensive work on that period. Brian Marvin Shukavark did this the book on Bhakti Vinod Thakur at Toronto, I don't know, some 20 or so years ago. So these things are coming up, but there's a lot of work to be done and can be done, because you've got a lot of materials that have been unlooked at. Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati and the Gauri Amat, left largely untouched by Western scholars until Ferdinando and one or two others get into it. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, again, a large body of his material, and like Tagore, he was something of a poet and a songwriter as well as something of a theologian, and as Tagore was a managed zamindari estates, Kedarnath Dutta was a deputy magistrate running a good chunk of the British Empire for a while. So, and it was very interesting that one of Tagore's older brothers, and I'm not sure whether it was Dijendranath or another of the Endranaths, befriended young Kedarnath Dutta when, as a young man, his family was largely wiped out in the cholera epidemic, and he found himself in Calcutta and was taken in. There's a lot of material that can be looked at and is being looked at now.
Just one other question. Tagore, at least in what you presented here.
Well, that's the real Tagore, no doubt about it. Yes, go ahead. I'm sorry, I'm silly.
He sort of integrates some of the devotion to Krishna and Radha from the Vaishnava groups, and at least sort of some of their sentiments and some of their imagery. Does he do something similar with Chaitanya himself, or is that sort of a figure that he sort of leaves largely untouched?
I think it's largely untouched. I think he must have a poem or two somewhere where he addresses Chaitanya. A very good question. And can you help us on that one, Kitty?
I can't. No.
No.
No, okay. I can think of other poets from the Sanskrit tradition that he calls up, but he seems almost purposely to this under wraps and to universalize the religious perceptions mm-hmm. and spirituality, so that it's shareable.
This interesting comment that he makes to Hemanta Bala, that yes, at one time he immersed himself in the Chaitanya Bhagavat, so he certainly knew of Chaitanya, did he ever... He must have written some things on Chaitanya, but my wife has not pointed any of these out. She's been very helpful in pointing me to certain things and then make me work on them. She hasn't pointed me to a Chaitanya one, and I don't know. Does there exist as yet a... what do you call it? We have all the words in a from a not a lexicon, concordance. Yes, I think the Ratchanavali, his works are now available on the internet or in disc or something. But we've got the bound volumes, but it's hard enough to find an index in there too. But I don't think we have a concordance. But I will search on that, since I've gotten this far in. It's a very basic question. But it didn't crop up, and I've been peeking around from different angles.
The person who would know would be Shukanta Chaudhary.
Shukanta.
Of Dadapur. Native Dadapur.
Very good.
Who has translated so much of Rabindranath mm-hmm. and knows his works from end to end.
Good. Well, I'll make a quick check on that.
He would be able to tell you, too. Possibly there is an online
concordance, do you suppose?
Access to words. There ought to be.
I'm asking because I know, like some of the other thinkers in that period did have something to say on Chaitanya.
Yeah, no, he undoubtedly has, but without a concordance, I wasn't able to track it down, and it hadn't come across me or my Robi Guru. I refer to my wife as my Robindranath, my Robi Guru. She points me and gives me dig darshan, you know. Yeah.
I was wondering, no doubt he takes, you could say, the love between Radha and Krishna symbolically and metaphorically, as many people of that time did. Also the story in the Bhagavata, the Rasa Leela, mm-hmm. and these things were taken as expressing that feeling more than as sacred mm-hmm. history. But in his poems, he refers to the Dark Lord, and was in his own practice, was he a Vaishnava in the sense that did he believe, okay, no, Krishna is sort of a divinity, but the stories surrounding him aren't necessarily true, aren't history, and or was everything for him? Also, even the idea of the Dark Lord was a metaphor. Did he consider himself a Vaishnava, and also how much was he influenced by the, you know, by the you could say the Shakta tradition, the other big tradition in Bengal? Did he show any allegiance to that?
He would. He had let's just distinguish what you find in the Bhanasinapadavali, which he was working on. Started working on. Couldn't have been any older than 13, because the first ones start coming out when he's 14, and a few years later you get the whole batch of them. So there he is deliberately doing a Vaishnava kind of poem, so he's using the imagery and the name. He doesn't use the imagery very much later on. The quotation that I took from Tony Stewart has him... the quotation I took from Tagore himself at a much later time. That was out of the Religion of Man lectures that he gave over here at Manchester College, where he says of finding this document in his youth, and then said, I saw this underlying theme of devotion to the divine. Whether he really felt that spiritual as the 13-year-old or not, I don't know. If you look at P.K. Mukherjee's Rabindra Jeevani, I think, the Rabbi Jeevani is the other fellow, Rabindra Jeevani, there he suggests that he was much more interested in the language than he was on the, if you will, the spirituality of it. His reflections back at age 70 or so suggest that he felt a a more religious personal involvement in reading those poems. He certainly at times, for a good chunk of his life, seemed to have a sense of the divine as very personal and a very significant personal devotional relationship to him, the religion of a poet, as he loves to call it. But he would very much hesitate to call himself a Vaishnava or call himself a Shakta or a Shaiva. He has an ongoing polemic, really, against the specifically organized religious traditions, which I think makes it difficult for him to deal with the Muslims generally, except for certain individuals who are highly sophisticated and cosmopolitan. Within the Hindu side, you have more of a range of folks, but the more the persons consider themselves strictly Vaishnava or Shakta, the more he seems to draw away. At the very end of his life, according to some people, he seems to even have been pulling away from his faith in the personalness of the divine as well, though still having a sense that there is meaning to human life. Whether this is Sukumari Bhattacharji and others are exaggerating this or not, I don't know, but there seems to be a towards the end of his life that kind of pulling back. But certainly there was a generic devotee quality to much of what he was saying along the way, but to put it in a Vaishnavite form. But my sense is that the sort of spirituality he had is much more resonant with the Vaishnavite spirituality if you eliminate the surface imagery. He kept the surface imagery when he was doing the Bhano Sinapadavali, but as far as I know, he doesn't do that again.
Mm. Yeah. I was a bit thrown by his allusions to his inclinations to asceticism and Shiva and that whole thing with the Jamuna merging with the Ganga, and how that fit in with his his religion of man, and it seems to sort of be contradictory to that.
Well, there's an ascetic side to Rabindranath. My goodness, in the early days of the ashram school, he had the children dressing up as brahmacharis and this sort of thing. They were vegetarian anyway, probably thanks to the Brahma Samaj. It was a relatively austere kind of life that he had, not as extremely austere as Shiva going around naked with ashes on him or something. The boys all would, they wore something, but something very simple. So the aesthetic, the ascetic aspect as well as the aesthetic is certainly part of his way of life, but not as extreme even as Gandhi, but certainly much more extreme than the Bhadralok down in Calcutta, who didn't really like the idea of this school out there in Shantiniketan. The idea of getting yourself dirty, going out to the fields and whatnot, he was all in favor of that, though I don't think he did too much digging himself. But he was being a bit playful at that point. It's a very delightful correspondence, at least the one side that you get of it, in his bouncing back and forth from this Hemantabala, and he sort of teasingly plays around with these images. But as he says somewhere in here, the images I can use if they express my feelings, but I'm not bound to them anyway. And the dancing, yes, Nataraj, Shiva, both the ascetic and the dance. And goodness knows Tagore loved to dance. Rabindranrithir is a whole tradition of that. But the Vaishnavas love to dance too, so it doesn't make them sectarianly. Can I see a waving over here a moment ago, or maybe you're waving at the clock or something? I know some of us will want to run off to what's her name. Okay, good. June McDaniel's doing something at 3:30 over at the Anthropology. We should break up in time for getting over there for those who I've known, not well, but I've known her for many years, and she does some interesting things. And Professor Sain has just finished reading her Madness of the Saints.
Well, perhaps we should stop at this point then.
If there's no further questions, comments, I'm very happy that you could be here.
Well, thank you very much for a very interesting paper and a thought-provoking paper, too.
Very good. The audience.